Now we take up a rather long poem, and one which has appeared several times. I don't know that I approve of this much exposure, as it were, of the poem. I'm not sure it's good enough for that. It first appeared in Searchlight in 50. It appeared in Shenandoah in 51 and was reprinted in 8 American Poets. The title is For a Prisoner, 1949. It concerns a man who was charged with rape and who was subsequently executed. He was black enough to dim the sun and large of bone. His sly, tiny head trembled with unfamiliar fear. His mouth was tense like a scream by sharp, unuttered protest, but his eyes were wild and sad and lost. Because he couldn't quite understand. His crime, they said, was rape, which we were all forced to admit was self-expression or assertion, if it was anything at all, and like good social workers, we knew it had to be something. And I, who wept at movies, remembered the itch of lust, the knife of pain, and the always unexpected, always predicted, and always human fear like an undone heart in the night when anybody's world unreasonably shivers down. Be kind, I thought I might have meant almost to say. He's one of us. None of us said that. Came from an old TV play, which came from a musty old novel by somewhat musty Joseph Conrad. Did I, in fact, say anything at all? And did anyone laugh at me, at you? What I generally managed to forget, I am weak as any man. I have felt when the floating, lucid, nighttime mind abruptly forgets even the possibility of the milk-bland Reader's Digest, pre-digested almost world, the silly, niggling, ape-old and compulsive hunger of the flesh, the ambiguous, ineffable smarting and persistent longing of the soul for something or other. And when they put the rope around his sweating neck, I'll know it. I don't shudder for his mistake. My errors are not fatal. But what about that night when I awake and the breath being stopped by the bruising cord is uniquely and unquestionably just mine, and what's left skyrockets off to meet the blue lightning that plays behind my eyes? What if I am not dreaming? The bulk of the verse which I have read thus far, as you will have noticed, makes great use of prose rhythms, or at least I trust that rhythm, because I hope so. The poem that follows, which for some reason, unknown to me, seems to have pleased a surprisingly large number of people, is rather more metrical. Although it does not employ rhyme, it does employ a variable foot and will scan out roughly on a sort of accentual basis. It appeared again, as did one other I read you, in the Necromanticon in about 52. The Necromanticon was short-lived but ghoulish in its time. The title of this particular poem is His Majesty at Midnight, and it is based directly on an incident in which Sir James Frazer, in his Golden Bough, tells us is fairly common among primitive tribes. What surprised me was that, having written this by the book, as it were, about what Frazer said, I should end up with a poem that seems very much steeped in Freudian imagery. In any case, let's see what it comes to. He sits in the disenchanted dark, one sleeping hand holds fast his sword, and grim his mouth that knew no laughter before or now, so fierce a man that none can face him unafraid, but in the dark he hears too clearly the mutter of his arteries to the unrepentant bone, and the dreadful communion of the currents of his brain, saying he is old and lost. But he is chief among them yet, with none so mighty that can take his throne. But he remembers his youth, when the strongest rule, to be a king, you must kill a king. His urgent mad blood can dampen your hand to glory. Or once he thought, not knowing the whispering dark tongues of the night, But midnight has told him all that it knows, and he must answer. He sold his heart for his body's honor, and now he waits in utter terror, lest some fool, bold with blood, try to unflesh him from his solitary crown. Well, that's a bit removed from my experience. The poem which I'd like to read to you now, which is pretty short, appeared in a magazine that I edited for a couple of years called Spearhead. This appeared in the last issue before the editors themselves wafted off into the Korean crisis. It would be helpful to keep in mind, I imagine, so far as this particular verse is concerned, to remember that the title is a direct quotation. I really did fly, Mother. And it is followed by a condensed news item from a newspaper. So the verses themselves are based on something which indeed did happen. And this is the clipping from the newspaper. Using a bath towel as a flying blouse, 6-year-old Richard Bonham took off from a 20-foot cliff near his home. He died from internal injuries. Thought that he'd fly, not like a cloud, the whim of any breeze, but like a bird with bones of air and a heart of hollow. No time for love. Stay high from earth or you'll get caught, but only fight against the wind. Pump, pump, and swoop, glad like a gull on the waking air. Thought he'd fly, but fell, and broke on dirt. Found earth his proper home, forgiving pain his proper end. Well, the next poem gets a little bit closer to me, and a little closer home, I might say. It appeared in a publication called Autumn Annual about 11 years ago. The title is The Smell of Mortality, which is paraphrased from King Lear, and the dedicatory part of the title runs from my grandfather, 1947. And I must say, I don't really, when I think about it, find the poem at all amusing. The cancer blossomed like a dark and bloody flower on his face. The persistent scent assaulted his indignant nostrils. His blue, innocent eyes shrank back in horror from the coarse red laughter of the wound. The sharp, insistent pain claimed his lively nerves, and sleep, the sloth of death, withdrew. I see no dignity in this dying, he said, and took his gun. But the doctors, who, whatever else they had heard of Hippocrates, impounded this sucker and kept him waiting on his bitter, lonely, drugless, insane bed. And the next one, I'm glad to say, is rather more imaginary than otherwise. His only publication, again, was in the English anthology, 8 American Poets, and nobody that I've ever come across except the editor of that anthology actually liked it. It's called The Accident, and goes something like this. Attention compelled by the clamorous noise is held by the stillness when the moment is transfixed forever beyond any now. C. A terrific pole established for communication solely has neatly split the car whose antique shattered hull quaintly quivers in the hush. It alone dares offer motion. Behind the webbed glass a face white with life would look, except that he might see why the others do not speak. He cannot comprehend this doom by speed impelled, or why he doesn't die. Not for him will the moment pass. I know this scene must explode into ruin, and horror unify, as blood must burn and flesh cry out, the hollow crowd which waits, as even time awaits, its dreaded signal to resume. And the next poem is one of perhaps two which I have written, which I rather like. I'm not going to assert that it's really poetry, but it seems to me to pretty well get down to saying, putting before you what it tries to. It appeared in Matrix, a little magazine published in California in about 1950. and was reprinted again in the Eight American Poets Anthology. The title is Hospital Scene 1. In the antiseptic rooms these people sit, who wait with dim, lost eyes, as interns pass with undertaker's tread. These people cannot speak. The mind too shocked for grief can only wait as the pulse beats time. They wonder if this nurse, who lost in dream thinks wholly of tonight, might give them news of one of theirs who undergoes the blood-white miracle of surgery to carve his suppliant flesh into a functional design. Time pauses for a door to open. They look up as the primeval heart pounds to see the bright vision of smiling God with a scalpel. Although the next item is related to that which we have just read, we're back into suck egg mule territory again. This is called Hospital Scene 2 and was reprinted, as some of the others were, in Eight American Poets. He lay on his bed and listened to the minute march of minutes in his frail blood. Three dim flies claimed the ceiling. If forever would pause, I'd interrupt those flies. He saw the white walls flow like processional seas across his mind. The light bulb moved perpetually forward to nowhere. He laughed, and the world closed on him like a flower. The next poem is called Sunday Morning, and I think perhaps I like it best of all the attempts I've made to get things down in some sort of verse. It appeared in Shenandoah, Washington Lee University's magazine, and went in 1950 and was also picked up for the anthology we previously alluded to. I might say that this poem has been reprinted in various newspapers, magazines, and so on any number of times, and it's rather pleased me. I was trying to get across what it's like to wake up very early Sunday morning in our house, which is high above the street. The sound of the arrogant church bells scrapes sleep from minds absorbed with love and death in careful beds. Behind the house, a cat walks with the white feet of a king among overturned garbage pails. And in the drug streets, the people, oh, the ponderous people, move in silence deeper than a dream. And this poem, next, which is called Poem, concerns my cat and his nighttime activities. He's a tomcat, but not typical, I think. He is more a fighter, I'm afraid, than a lover. This was first printed in Shenandoah and also went into the Eight American Poets, and I'm very glad to see it go there. Green Knight has misinformed this cat, who thinks himself such a savage saber-tooth. Silently he goes, a shadow deeper than simpering trees. Reflections of the stars pass a white word to the shallow waiting pond. Here things live. Disdaining the clutch of weeds, the cat leans far over to consider the image sky implanted beneath the gray water. One deadly paw jabs at a shining slim fish which slides away. No matter. The predator has wiser plans. Carefully he waits, as fireflies ponder on his scheme, for this mad cat would siphon up the moon. As I say, he was, I don't know whether he was mad or not, but he certainly didn't strike me as being quite normal. The following poem has a pretty long title. More of a title, I think, than the verses themselves deserve. Its only publication was in the British Anthology, already mentioned. And when I finish the title, I'll say so, so you won't think we busted into the poem. The title is The Organization Man, having discovered certain deficiencies in himself, dictates his first and last love letter. And what follows is this businessman's love letter. Gardenias in a white bowl in clear water, floating, not caring their corrupt beauty embraces the air with essence so purple it might well be inevitable sin. In the room delight lies thick, for here is something perfect, something, well, real. And perfection makes its plain appeal, requiring the perfected response of eyes, nose, hands, and all. No blindness anywhere. And so you call for, not by demanding, not by asking, being, just being, all my rusty equipment of appreciation. Each day, things must be done. And the patterns, if one likes them, are the same. Morning with coffee, no time for the birds, then going and coming, people to be seen or not seen, strings to be pulled or let alone, food to eat and letters to write, being a dozen men but never one, of the thousand faces, several to each friend but only one for the enemy. I sense a lack of focus. But you, entering the room, make unguessed demands. On that I have hidden away, perceiving you perfectly, as any rose should be known, requires totality, that withered weed poets used to name, the heart. All false faces fade away, and I am left with what I am, with what I'm not. Hollow, hungry, mute, previously blind, lest your abundance fill me up and give me speech. Here are some occasional verses. The occasion was my departure from Nashville, Tennessee to return to Virginia. And as I was driving from Tennessee back to Virginia, I jotted down these stanzas on some sort of paper I had in the front seat of the car. And it's addressed to some very dear friends of mine in Nashville. And it might be of some interest to know just who the people alluded to are. Ezra, of course, is Mr. Ezra Pound, who was at that time lodged in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington. Wyndham, old blind Wyndham, is the late Wyndham Lewis, one of the most underrated but masterly writers of our time. Daft Andrew is Daft Andrew Lytle, a marvelously gifted writer of fiction. Stout Davidson, Mr. Donald Davidson, who is a gentleman well known for having the courage of his convictions. The procrastinator Kirk would be Mr. Russell Kirk, the well-known conservative philosopher. Young Ashley would be Ashley Brown, budding critic. I don't know if he's flowered yet or not. Old Caroline would be Miss Caroline Gordon, one of the best one of the best lady writers of fiction which this country is yet to turn out. Flannery, Miss Flannery O'Connor, who is indeed the saint referred to here. Lon and Fanny would be Mr. and Mrs. Brainerd Cheney, to whom the poem is in fact addressed. As is readily apparent, the rhyme scheme is rather casual, left almost to chance. And as to the actual scansion of the thing, it was done completely by ear. I have no idea how it would work out if someone would try to mark it out with pen or pencil. But it seemed to fit the ear very well. The date would be June 1956, I think. My master Ezra, whom sometime I served, has got perhaps what he deserved. The mad girl's wail above the TV set, such monstrous progeny, may honesty beget. It is blind Wyndham who might show the way. The eye of the mind sees a different day. But since Descartes scrapped substantial form, he has but ideas to keep his ideas warm. To students and to crocodiles, Daft Andrew, lost in Everglades, proclaims the sanctity of the word. At least the pale goddess overheard. Stout Davidson, a plain, blunt man, who as a man does what he can, with air attuned to folkish song, lends his good name to churlish wrong. The procrastinator Kirk ham bone in hand, speaks joyfully of his barren land, then having been most amply dined, expounds the simple, conservative mind. Young Ashley, master of integritas, perceives analogies, pursues old Caroline, canny fox half-hid by Jungian trees. But Flannery is a rarer saint than these. Convivial Lon Odessus wives, loves God and politics and plays. Sweet Fanny Grace to civilize, articulates Smyrna Suarez. Through Cheney kindness, Tennessee becomes a gracious memory, while Virginia, godless as William James, waits for some god to give citizens names.